Welcome to Dairy Livestream. I'm your host, Corey Geiger, managing editor of Hordes Dairyman. We're broadcasting from our Cheese Cave, our studio in downtown Fort Atkinson at the historic W.D. Hort & Sons company building commissioned by Wisconsin's 16th Governor William Dempster Hort and also the founder of Hordes Dairyman. Our conversation today will focus on the fuel, feed, and fertilizer forecast. I'm so pleased to have four outstanding thought leaders, and based on our dress rehearsal yesterday, we'll have a diverse discussion on this topic. As a reminder to everyone in our audience, this webcast will be available on our Hordes Dairyman YouTube channel 24 hours after the live event. Dairy Livestream is also available anywhere you want to listen to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Search for Dairy Livestream from the convenience of your smartphone to download it. As you hear from our panelists, please submit your questions into the GoToWebinar question panel. The earlier you ask a question, the more likely it will get asked on the air. Let's get rolling with the conversation, the fuel, feed, and fertilizer forecast. Before hearing from Gary Schitnicki, let's go to our first poll question. Potash prices have been in the $400 per ton range prior to COVID-19. What is the current prevailing retail price for potash? And so your options are $400 per ton, $600 per ton, $800 per ton, and $1,000 per ton. And so let's see what the audience has to say on that front. And certainly potash is a fertilizer that goes is craved by forage crops. So the right answer, 61% of our audience said $800. And I, you know what, if you have to talk about delivered retail price of potash, maybe it is pushing $1,000 per ton in some areas. So we welcome University of Illinois Gary to our Dairy Livestream. And since 1998, Gary has been a professor at the University of Illinois, where he focuses on farm management and specializes on economics and risk management in the heart of America's Corn Belt agriculture area. And if you're in the Corn Belt, that means focus on corn and soybeans. Gary shared with us through the University of Illinois Farm Management Program, Gary tracks input costs and returns on over 25% of the cropped acres in the land of Lincoln. Given Illinois' importance to the growing dairy ration concentrates, we welcome Gary's outlook and insight into the upcoming year. Gary, thanks for joining us on Dairy Livestream.
Thanks for having me, Corey, and it's a pleasure to be here. And as we're looking forward into the major inputs, and I'm gonna focus here first on fertilizer, then on fuel, and then finally on corn and soybeans. Fertilizer prices obviously have gone up and have gone up tremendously. And we saw those really start going up last year in September and October and have gone up tremendously. And there's a lot of factors that contribute to that. But one of the big ones right now that are having an impact on those fertilizer prices and not likely to see those come down is the Ukraine-Russia conflict. Russia happens to be a major producer of nitrogen as well as natural gas, and natural gas goes to Europe, and Europe faces much higher natural gas prices, and so their nitrogen fertilizer sector is really, really facing difficulty, and potash and phosphates as well. There's a lot of those inputs moving out of Russia and moving around the world, but there's still sanctions on Russia. And there's also that Ukraine-Russia has just made those supply chains much more difficult to manage. As a result, we see these high fertilizer prices stubbornly high, and I really do not see those coming down into the spring. And probably the event that causes them to come down would be corn and soybean prices, because they're highly correlated. And at this point in time, you're not looking for corn and soybean prices to come down either. So if you're looking at those prices, you know, moving into the spring, probably no relief and stuck at stubbornly high levels. Fuel, we still see diesel fuel at higher levels, diesel in particular. And again, that's a refining issue and a demand issue. And there might be more backing off of fuel, but I wouldn't bet on it either. I mean, those input prices are stuck there and may come down a bit, but I wouldn't bet on that too much. As far as corn and soybeans, the outlook for corn and soybeans are for some downward pressure. Right now, we're looking at cash prices sort of in the 680 range for corn, and we're sort of projecting for in the fall 560 to 580 for corn. Soybeans would have a similar pattern. What that is based on, that decline, is normal yields. So if you're looking at Brazil and Argentina, they planted a crop. They planted more acres of soybeans than they did last year. And if they have normal yields or above even, and the U.S. doesn't have a drought, we could be looking at much lower prices. By that, I mean 580-ish come the next fall. If we have tremendous yields, those will come down. But until we see those supply issues, some sort of good yield someplace, and again, we're below trend on both corn and soybeans in this country in 2022. Until we see those above trend, probably not looking at much decrease in those prices moving forward. So it's weather, and that will be determining those corn and soybean prices.
So Gary, what you're really, I mean, as we enter this, for many farmers, this is a big time of year for tax planning and that. And if you're, what I'm hearing from you is if farmers have the wherewithal to prepay fertilizer in those kind of inputs, that prices are going to probably hold through spring. Is that kind of the
I'm sort of that opinion that we're not going to see price declines moving into spring. And that's sort of based on the Ukraine-Russia war not being settled, but not getting worse. We're sort of living with where we're at and sort of no big issues. So, yeah. And we talk about those coming down. They could also go up if we have any sort of supply issues associated with natural gas or anything else. So we're still living in this very volatile time. So pricing now for tax seems like a good strategy to me if we have that tax obligation to worry about.
And it certainly appears that both sides in the Ukraine-Russia conflict are potentially in it for long haul. An announcement just came out in the last 24 hours that the U.S. government is starting to send Patriot missiles to Ukraine, and that's the best equipment we've sent. So certainly, that situation will probably not cool for the foreseeable future. So thank you, Gary. Before we hear from Joe Lawrence, let's go to another poll question, and Caitlin will put that on the screen. Have higher input costs caused you to adjust your manure management strategy? So there's four options here. Simple one is no. The second one is yes, a closer calculation of nutrient value. The third one is yes, change in application timing, and this would really be to maximize nutrient availability. And the fourth one there is yes, incorporation of manure into the soil, and that would be to conserve ammonia and nitrogen, which many dairy manures are very, very rich in. So let's see what the audience has got to say on this front. And if you're not a dairy farmer, but you advise farmers, go ahead and answer that poll as well. So a little bit all over the board here, Joe, and that'll be interesting for you to talk about and talk through because you've spent a lot of time because this poll question relates so importantly to the sky-high cost for commercial fertilizer. And we know dairy manure has a lot of great value in growing crops. So Joe Lawrence joined Cornell's Pro Dairy team in 2016 as a dairy forage system specialist. He focuses on dairy forage systems management, drawing from his experience working with the New York dairy industry as a private Sector Certified Crop Advisor, what some people would call CCA, and as a field crops educator for the Cornell's Cooperative Extension. The current work that Joe does works to integrate agronomic management of forage crops with forage and harvest feeding practices to optimize use of forages in dairy rations. These days, Joe's pivoted a little bit, spending more time on manure's value proposition as fertilizer. Joe, let's walk through the forage and manure economics proposition moving into the next year. And welcome to Dairy Livestream.
Yeah, Corey, thanks for having me today. It's great to be here. And so, yeah, we have, you know, obviously with dairy being a large sector of New York's agriculture, we have quite a bit of focus on nutrient management. And I'm just one piece of a team here at Cornell of a lot of research that goes on around the value of manure. And you know, I look at it definitely as it ties into homegrown forages for our dairy farm. So that's really the perspective I'm mainly, you know, coming at this from, is predominantly our dairy industry, you know, relies heavily on homegrown forages of corn silage, alfalfa, and grass hay crops. I think it's good to, you know, start out with, we're kind of coming into year two of this. So when a lot of these questions started last year, there was a lot of questions around, can we, you know, how do we get the most benefit out of our manure? And are there places to cut fertilizer? And, you know, not to be too tongue in cheek, but if there were big opportunities to cut fertilizer last year, then, you know, obviously that's kind of suggesting that maybe you were applying before that, because we know our crops need a certain amount of inputs to produce, and there's definitely a point of diminishing return there, where if we try to cut costs too much on the input side, we're gonna have negative consequences on the yield side, and that's, you know, could actually put us in a backward position. So I think as we go into year two of this, if you had some higher soil test levels, so knowing those levels, soil sampling, making sure you know what's out there, and if you had some higher levels and thought in 2022, well, I'm going to rely on drawing down those soil test levels a little bit to offset some inputs, we want to be careful doing that 2 years in a row. You know, I think that's a good starting point, is just to think about what changes we might have made in 2022, and if those would have any repercussions now that we're going into year two of this. In terms of, you know, fertilizer, I'll let Gary be the authority on, you know, walking in and that sort of stuff, but what I'm hearing from some of our suppliers on the ground here, at least in New York, is even if you're not going to lock in a price, they're looking for you to lock in tonnage, because, you know, they're telling me that their suppliers are unwilling to make, you know, commitments for the spring without firm orders. And so I think there's a bit of a worry there that if you don't lock in, at least lock in tonnage as early as you can, you may call for, you know, a load of fertilizer in the spring and they may not have it for you. So so I think, you know, as we consider things over the winter, we'll be looking out for that. Moving into manure, you know, it's a blessing and a curse, right? It can be a hard product to manage. It's bulky. There's some, you know, social factors that go along with it, but it is a real opportunity as a nutrient source. And, you know, back to the poll question, really diving in, getting some samples taken and analyzed to understand what the nutrient content of that manure is and how that fits into your system. And then, you know, really looking at what's feasible for application rates. And if you're in a state where you're confined by some sort of CAFO regulations or nutrient management plans, certainly taking that into account. But thinking about those things, we can, if we time application closer to when the crop is going to uptake those nutrients, we can be more efficient. If we can incorporate it into the ground in the spring to conserve that extra ammonium nitrogen in a liquid dairy manure, that can be 50% of the total nitrogen is in that ammonium form and would just be blown off to the atmosphere if we don't get it incorporated. And then, you know, maybe pushing the pencil, obviously fuel prices will factor into this, but pushing the pencil on where we go, how far away from the farmstead we can go with that manure economically based on higher fertilizer costs. And the final thing I would say is, you know, I certainly didn't coin this term, but manure often gets termed as being the multivitamin for crops because it brings in more than just the N, P, and K with it. And from that perspective, you know, we continue to look at nitrogen use efficiency, and we do this with some of our corn silage research trials. And we continue to see this soil health factor, and we can't always quantify it numerically, which, you know, tends to bother us as researchers sometimes, but definitely see that there's a resilience factor there where our where we see sites with a manure history that have more resilience to extreme weather events and can actually, you know, are utilizing N that we're not necessarily accounting for in our nitrogen accounting system. So we look at all the inputs of N, and we see these healthy soils on dairy farms where the crop would say that it actually needed more N than we supply, but the yields are telling us that we, you know, we really optimized yields there. So there's a, you know, there's that factor to think about too, as you look at your farm soil health, manure history on those fields and what it might be contributing that we don't always measure on paper. So I think I'll stop there right now in the interest of time.
Thank you so very much, Joe. And as a reminder to our large audience out there, if you have questions, go ahead and type them into our question panel of the GoToWebinar control panel, and we'll get those asked in the second half of the webcast. The beauty of Dairy Livestream is we answer your questions live on the air. With that, we're going to go to our another poll question before we hear from Steve Martin. And the question is this: what factors have been driving up prices via inflation, COVID-19 and the ensuing supply chain issues, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, China's COVID-19 lockdown policies, all the above or none of the above? So we'll go ahead and give people a little bit of time to answer that one. And certainly we could have put a lot longer list of things that are impacting inflation there. But let's go ahead and see what our audience had to say. And 91% of you said all of the above. And I think what one of the things we're talking through here is while we can make projections into the new year, many forces could change market conditions. I mean, there's so many things that have pivoted in the past, really since March of 2020 when COVID landed on the scene. So hence, I would personally contend the answer to that question, what factors have been driving inflation, would be all of the above. COVID-19 ensuing supply chain issues, and there's a laundry list of those. The Russian invasion in Ukraine and one of the great breadbaskets of the world, and certainly Russia being one of the world's biggest large suppliers of natural gas, and then COVID-19 lockdown policies of China, which they reportedly eased here this past week, but we got to see how that turns in practice. And that country is actually, growth rates have slowed quite a bit, and on the dairy front, that's a big impact because they are the world's largest dairy product importer. So with all that in mind, the question for us is, how will these tribulations impact feed prices? And we're going to turn to Steve Martin to answer that question. This Auburn and Texas A&M University graduate is the founder of DNMC Milk, or formerly known as Dairy Nutrition and Management Consulting. The business Steve founded works with dairy farmers throughout the West, Southwest, and the Texas Panhandle, and several other dairy regions in the U.S. and throughout the world. Steve, feed is the biggest expense item on the dairy. How are you approaching feed and nutrition?
Yeah, thank you, Corey, for the question and the opportunity to be on the podcast today. You know, we're always focused on managing feed costs, whether feed costs are high or low. But clearly, in the environment we find ourselves in now, everything is at a fevered pitch, and our goals looking into the new year, as we reflect on 2022, would be preserving margins. We have clearly a difference in milk pricing expectations probably for 2023 than we had for 2022, and that's not my area of expertise, but I think that we're figuring that we're going to have a lower value milk to sell, but at the same time we're probably for sure going to have higher feed input costs. So you know, we've been stepping into this reality since the summer and through this fall, and some producers had great positions on ingredients, and those contracts have run out obviously in the last 90 to 120 days, and they're experiencing significant increases in costs. The last piece of that for a lot of people would be when they run out of their 2021 silage and start transitioning into 2022 crop year silage. And the term Christmas corn silage may have been coined by Mike Hutchins, I'm not sure, but we're rapidly getting to where most all of our clients, if they're not already on new crop corn silage, they're starting to blend soon. So we're changing prices within our formulation models drastically, taking prices up 50% on some key forages that are at a very high percentage of the ration. So the feed cost numbers that we're seeing, cents per pound of dry matter that used to be around a dime in a lot of dairies out west and even across the country, those numbers are in the upper teens. So if we're feeding 17, 16 cents per pound dry matter, a dairy getting good milk is going to get 55 pounds or so of dry matter intake. That's a $9 feed cost. It's just new ground for us in the industry. We got to figure it out. And what's the correct reaction? What's the correct response? Do the rules change? Do we feed cows differently with these kinds of prices, or is the biology is the same? So the carbons and nitrogen and other things it takes to make milk, those rules don't change, but the value of them, the cost of them, and the value of what we're selling do change and have changed. So as we look at preserving those margins, we can't control the milk price really, but we can be thoughtful and creative and increase our flexibility on feed cost inputs. And we all have our favorite ingredients that we like to feed. I think right now our biases toward the way we like to feed cows may get challenged in 2023. It could be that things that you like to feed, that you have a good comfort level and history of feeding, they may not price in this year, and you may have to try something new. And with the with the advice of a strong nutrition council, we can remember the principle that we're going to preach a lot is that cows have requirements for nutrients, not ingredients. And cottonseed and alfalfa hay are probably my two favorite examples on the fact that cows don't need certain ingredients; they need the nutrients that those ingredients supply. So cottonseed has been an example, at $500 a ton, it's eased off a little bit now, maybe as we're in some gin run seed across the South. But, maybe cottonseed is something that you don't need to feed. And people have just drifted down the feed level of it to the point that it's not even worth having a commodity bay at the dairy for it. And so now it's time to take the leap, the emotional leap for some people, and take it out. And alfalfa hay is the same. It seems to be trending now to feed less alfalfa hay in the industry. out west. That's a very important thing to think about as it relates to the water requirement to grow alfalfa. But it could be that there are byproducts and roughages in your local area that can supply the nutrients that alfalfa supplies. So no doubt, cottonseed and alfalfa, good, great, wonderful dairy ingredients. Cows like them. They work well. But those are my two examples of taking some biases out of the way we feed cows, increasing our flexibility, making sure we're milking the right cows, looking at where your beef lines are. You probably ought to do some math on where the break even is on an individual cow is a potential early dry or a beef line. And don't forget, is a quick note on those late lactation cows that you're trying to make a decision on. Do some string samplings or some individual cow sampling and make sure you're using the right milk price for those cows, because they will have a significantly higher component reality than your bulk tank. So the beef line may be different than you think, and those cows may be actually making money because of their high solids and their lower intakes. So, you know, we're just trying to look at the managing input costs. That's the part that we can control, and using a lot of linear programming in the models to make sure we're feeding cows right and for as low possible cost as we can figure out how to do it.
Thank you very much, Steve. And it's a great discussion tying in some of the ingredient issues and thoughts from Gary and Joe. As a reminder to our audience, you can go ahead and ask questions in our GoToWebinar control panel, and we'll get those answered in the second half of the webcast. And we're going to go to our final poll question before we invite Chris Wolf to the stage, the virtual stage. If the Federal Reserve rate raises interest rates today, and we were talking about that before the webcast began, and that would be to further curb inflation, the action would represent what rate hike? The third straight hike, the fifth straight hike, the seventh straight hike, or the ninth? And this would be as measured by when the Federal Reserve actually comes together and meets. So let's go ahead and answer that question. We look forward to hearing the thoughts and what people are thinking about the economy there as it relates to cost of money. I was just talking to a gentleman this weekend who owns a paper mill, and his cost of interest, if he hadn't locked in his business loan at 4%, his payments would have moved to 8% on the open market, and that payment rate would have doubled. So this is a big impact. So let's go ahead and see what the audience has to say. So 54% of you said it was the fifth straight hike, and the correct answer is actually the seventh. Would be the seventh straight rate hike, and those actions appear to be stemming inflation, as we talked about in pre-broadcast mode. The inflation rate moved by just 0.1% now from October to November of this year, but over that 12-month horizon, we're still at high levels at 7.1%. Now, this is a balance of raising interest rates here, because we want to stem inflation, kind of be closer to a 2% level. That's what the Federal Reserve's goal is here. But if we also raise the cost of money too much, we could also slip into a recession, and that's a whole different discussion. So we welcome Cornell University's Chris Wolf back to Dairy Livestream. Chris, there are so many forces, market forces, interacting with one another. How might this impact dairy, especially as it relates to the feed, fuel, and fertilizer discussion?
Thanks, Corey. It's nice to be back with you again, talking about these issues. So we're talking about feed, fuel, fertilizer, right? Because U.S. farm milk price follows cost of production, particularly the feed price being by far the largest cost, right? So, but obviously this happens with the lag as those kind of expenses work their way through the system. And so now we've had a year, we're going into the second year of some of these really high prices. So they've had time to work through. Individual farmers are price takers, particularly when we're talking about corn and soybeans. But even the entire U.S. dairy industry is not large enough to really affect the international prices of corn and soybean markets. And that's why, we're watching what's going on in South America, and we're real interested in how much they planned and what their yields are going to look like, and what that might do to feed prices here if we're buying them. Because as was mentioned earlier, right, for 2022, it may have been the case that a lot of people had prepaid expenses. They've probably worked through those now. And so these cash prices are hitting home more than they were maybe a year ago. When we look at the farm business summary data, for the last 5 or 6 years, it's been pretty consistently that forage costs have increased kind of pretty consistently, whereas the grain and concentrate costs have kind of moved up or down kind of with the world market. Those forage prices really are heavily dependent on weather, like what Joe said. And so, you know, some people have had really good forages and some people have had real challenges. And, you know, you got people like Steve that have worked really hard to kind of deal with those different feed quality issues. And it's really kind of remarkable given the spread in kind of feed costs, especially forage costs, variation across the country, kind of how much kind of milk per cow and components have held up in some of those regions that have had to deal with those really high feed prices. And then we look at fertilizer, and it's really heavily tied to fuel, which is, you know, one of the other ones, because fuel is one of the major inputs when we're making the fertilizer. And we're looking at fertilizer prices that have doubled or even tripled in the last two and a half years. So that's pretty remarkable. And that's affecting things. It's affecting planting decisions here and elsewhere. And, you know, it's probably affecting the yield. I think Gary said we were off trend yield, and part of that's got to be just changing in fertilizer practices, I got to think. And then, as Gary highlighted, the ongoing war in Ukraine is at the heart of kind of what we're looking at for fuel and fertilizer issues. And, you know, Europe having to deal with natural gas shortages and house heating going into the winter, all of that. So these, you know, these globally interconnected supply chains on these, on the, you know, agri-food chains like we have now, mean that these supply disruptions in one region or sector of the world can lead to big consequences kind of in other sections of the world. And so it's one of those kind of trade-offs that we deal with when we have these deal with the free trade, and we gain things from free trade, but we also have to deal with it, right? And also the high fuel prices actually are not just affecting things in the dairy industry at the farm, right? $6 diesel makes it a lot harder to move milk around. And so we're looking at issues in some parts of the country that are actually having trouble getting milk moved in, like I'm thinking about the Southeast in particular here, where it, you know, moving milk from Texas to, like, let's say Georgia, is pretty difficult to do at $6 diesel. Like, what? So it's affecting, you know, the demand side also. And then I guess finally, you know, the question that led into this, the poll question about interest rates, you know, the cost of borrowed capital is an issue that's going to have implications at the farm level all the way through the supply chain in 2023. Tuesday, as Corey mentioned, we had a softer than expected inflation increase, even though it was 7.1% year over year. That's something else when you're talking about 7.1% being softer than expected. But you know, a lot of this moves on what the market was expecting versus where we come in at, right? And that was, in fact, the fifth straight decline in inflation rate from year over year from the month before. So, you know, at this point, and coming into this broadcast today, they hadn't announced a decision yet, but the expectation was that the Federal Reserve would increase by 0.5% or 50 basis points. And that's going to take that overnight borrowing benchmark rate that all of the lenders benchmark to 4.25% to 4.5%, somewhere in that range. And that's the highest level it's been at in 15 years. After a couple decades of very cheap money, the interest rates are going to work all the way through and affect the kind of supply response all the way through from farm level through the processors and retailers. So that's another thing to watch.
Chris, you know, I think especially some of us who are maybe on the younger side, we've gotten lulled into low cost of money. And that's not normal business climate practices. And, you know, people may have to really recalibrate their brain, because these interest rates may go up, they may come down some, but we've had historically cheap money, and I find it difficult that that's going to continue.
Thoughts? Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I teach an ag finance class, which I've been teaching for a couple decades at this point. And usually when we talk about interest rates, and I throw up a graph of historic interest rates, and I say, listen, we can't stay like at zero forever, but I've got a whole generation of students that I've taught now. Heck, I've got some of those students' kids, and they're still hearing the same story for me. But I guess if you keep saying it long enough, eventually you'll be right. But we really have been cheap, and you adjust to that, right? And you anchor to what you're used to, and we've anchored to those low interest rates. It's a big deal.
Gary, you were smiling when I asked that. I'm sure you have just come walking.
So I'm like Chris. I've been saying that you've been with higher interest rates for a very long time, and actually since 2008 has been the big deal when we kind of began quantitative easing. But coming forward, you know, if we're looking at a inflation rate of 2 to 4%, which would be mild compared to where we're at right now, but say we get to that point, you know, interest rates over the long run, if you want to build in any sort of margin above that to provide a rate, would be, you know, 5 to 6%, and then you're looking at loans 8 to 10%, and we haven't been there, and that will cause recalibration of the way you think about loans. It's also going to cause a recalibration about the way you think about asset prices, because we've been used to having very low interest rates, and that pushes up farmland prices and stock prices, and now we're not in that environment anymore, and it's likely that we see at best farmland prices, stock prices, any asset prices remaining stable for a very long time, and that would be a good case scenario. So, you know, and you could actually see declines, but we're now in that environment where we can't build in higher asset prices because interest rates are coming down. So
one of our audience questions comes in here, and I think Gary and Joe and Chris could all chime in on this, but I think we'll start with Gary. Does it make sense to utilize my co-op's financing loan of 3% to prepay fertilizer now, or take a wait and see approach?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And here's what I would typically tell people. And again, if you got tax issues, then handle those tax issues. But if you're just sort of looking at this from a risk standpoint, I would think about pricing that nitrogen at multiple points in time, because we don't actually know what's going to happen in the spring. But price it now and price it later, and you're going to be wrong on one of those, but you won't be wrong on both. The other thing that I would say is I agree with Joe. You're going to have to tell your suppliers what your needs are. Everybody in that fertilizer supply chain is skittish, and they want to know, you know, and you might not have to price it now, but, you know, that supply chain is we will most likely get all of our fertilizer needs, but that supply chain has been stretched. Let's just say it that way.
Joe or Chris, anything to add on that front? Let's talk about, you know, once we get the crops harvested, let's talk about feed shrink, because that can be a simple way to avoid losing your feed investment. What are some areas farms should be looking up to tighten up that area of focus, Steve?
Yeah, you know, this might be a good year. Had some people made some money this year. This might be a good year to prepay a new feed center, build some walls to block some wind, and we see some feeding areas that are going up around the neighborhood that are enclosed. And when you start looking at the dollars of feed costs that we're managing, the return on investment for improved storage and mixing technology is probably well spent. And so I think that that, you know, whether it's wind or rain, silage covering, investing in the oxygen barrier upgrade on your silage covering, you know, another packing tractor, all these things become easier to pay for as the cost of the value of what you're protecting goes up. So yes, and that's bunk management as well. You know, back in 2009, we learned how to manage bunks in a way we hadn't before, to keep cows accountable to bunk, to make sure we're not throwing away extra refusals. And I think we've held on to that. And maybe the next step is even a more fine-tuned approach to pushing up feed, managing feed bunks to get just in time delivery of feed, so that we don't have it at risk of weather during the day and night.
Thank you, Steve. We, Hordes Dairyman has multiple language editions, and we have readers and listeners around the world. This is from one of our international listeners here today. The question is, and this is a lot longer term horizon, Joe, and I'm going to answer a little bit of it, but you can add into it, please. What is the expectations for 2023 and 2024 alfalfa, as it is expected? I'm seeing on the horizon, this reader, listener says, a huge increase in prices. What about moving to feeding grasses for like fescue or oats, for example? Would it be a better choice or solution in duration? And as Joe and probably Steve are considering answering that question, we are want to remind everyone in the audience, we're at like alfalfa acreages that are pushing 100-year lows. Some of that's driven by the high returns on corn and soybeans that we've had the last couple of years. Some of this is driven by potash prices. Some of this is driven by water. There's a lot of complexities coming in here. So, Joel, you spend a lot of time in this forage space. What would you advise, you know, not only a U.S. Dairy farmer, but maybe somebody who's importing forages?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it is interesting to see the trends of alfalfa here in the U.S. And, you know, again, even total acreage, but not just that, but what's being fed here domestically versus what's being exported. And, you know, I think, so a couple of thoughts here that I'll start with just the, from an input standpoint, I mean, you know, we can make a lot of milk on grass. It does feed differently than alfalfa, and the nutritionist has to account for that. It tends to be higher in fiber, but also higher in fiber digestibility. But to get a good quality grass, it takes quite a bit of nitrogen. So from a cost input structure, it's to really feed a grass to get good yield and quality is, you know, that cost is up right now with nitrogen prices. So I think, you know, I don't know how that will compare on the market in terms from cost of alfalfa versus grass. And then a second thought is just, you know, I think, and Steve will have, you know, input here, I'm sure, but just thinking about that whole idea of digestible nutrients in our forage and getting away from some of the metrics we used to, you know, maybe rely on more like crude protein and that sort of thing. Because, you know, we also know grasses can be a lot less forgiving than alfalfa in the harvest. So if you miss that optimum harvest window with grass, especially if you're looking at crude protein, it's going to go down a lot faster than alfalfa will. However, if we look at fiber digestibility and digestible nutrients, even though alfalfa will tend to hold that protein content a little longer into the later harvest, fiber digestibility continues to go down. So if we're looking at purchasing alfalfa, I think it's really important to look at a full forage analysis and really understand, because sometimes we can get a later cut alfalfa that still looks decent from a protein standpoint, but has really gone downhill on a fiber digestibility side, and that's going to potentially make it less, you know, economical in a feeding program.
Steve, when you're on farm and talking to your dairymen and dairywomen, what's that forage discussion look like in crop planning?
Well, in the West, alfalfa feed rates have been on the decline for at least 10 years. And I would say that that will continue mostly because of water irrigation issues. You know, alfalfa surprisingly can hold value in a linear programming type approach in a ration balancing at prices that would surprise you from time to time. But when you step back and you look at it holistically, it's usually not the cheapest way to get cows fed. And I mean, you need to think about issues like, are you talking about hay or silage? And so, you know, different qualities of alfalfa and different qualities and types of grass are more forgiving in silage sometimes than they are in hay. You know, there's haylage that we feed that if it was baled hay, it would be dry cow feed, but as a haylage, it milks fine. So the things that Joe said about fiber digestibility are all true. The funny thing about, you know, when I look at the things we do in Florida versus, you know, places like New Mexico and then in Washington State, each place has its own calculus on what's right. And, you know, part of that is what are the byproduct opportunities to come back and behind and fill in the gaps from your forage availability. And so forage quality out west to me means feed that doesn't have mold or dirt or weeds in it. The maturity is not that problematic because some of the diets we work with, getting enough of that indigestible fiber to keep the cow healthy and keep feed conversions in check is about as important as anything. So if you have a ration that's 35 to 40% forage, you know, you need some fiber in that forage to keep the cow healthy. If you're in New York or Wisconsin, you know, you need high digestibility fiber in your forages so you can feed more of it and purchase less inputs for the farm. So it almost could not be more different between the East and the West on that exact issue. And, you know, we live and die on byproducts out West, and, you know, maybe that's not the way the cows were designed to be fed, but we, like Chris said, and I do hear what you say. I appreciate the nod that we have figured it out. You know, we figured out how to feed cows with less roughage and still maintain cow health and reproduction and components.
Gary, I think this next question here is something that you've faced, and then Joel can do a little follow-up here, but even though fertilizer has been so expensive, when you talk to farmers, crop farmers, what are some areas farmers should definitely not skimp on applying fertilizer? Because I mean, really, it's the food to grow crops.
Yeah. So the big one, and again, this is a Midwest perspective. Generally speaking, the P and the K. A lot of our soils in the Midwest are above minimum levels, so we may be able to skimp there a little bit. And again, I would put it not skimping so much as getting back to where we should be, not in optimal ranges. But the one where you can't do without is nitrogen and corn, and wheat as well. But if we're looking at corn and nitrogen, we need that nitrogen there. And I would say, again, going back and thinking about getting those nitrogen rates near where universities recommend, and not going below that, but we also don't need to be above it. But you don't want to go below those university recommended rates because you will suffer typically yield losses from there. So you do need that nitrogen.
Joe, what are you seeing out your way?
Yeah, I would agree totally. I mean, we tend, you know, our dairy systems tend to be pretty flush with phosphorus and potassium as well from manure, and the soil does hold on to that better. So we have those supplies in the soil. Again, we can't draw down on them year after year without eventually having a problem. But for a few years, a lot of our soils can probably tolerate that. And I totally agree on the nitrogen standpoint. Again, maybe a little difference in a dairy system is how we credit that nitrogen and making sure we're crediting all the sources of nitrogen in that system from past manure applications and stuff. But that comes out of that number Gary's talking about. So start with that calculation of how many total pounds of nitrogen you're going to need, and then back off some of those credits that we may have from crop rotation or manure or that sort of thing. The only other thing I'd throw in, and it may seem kind of simplistic, but it still comes up more than I'd like, is lime. You know, it's the backbone of all of this. And if you look at nutrient availability in soil, a lot of times, when our pH even gets down into the low sixes, nutrients like phosphorus can be less than 60% available. So when we talk about having maybe higher levels of phosphorus in some of our soils, but if you're at a lower pH, it's going to be more locked up in the soil. So if we get out there with lime, we could have an effect of just making more of the phosphorus that's already there plant available. So I think, you know, that's another, it's if it hasn't been addressed on the farm, it's kind of low-hanging fruit.
Chris, we're spending, and certainly because of the design of this webcast, a lot of discussion on fuel, feed, and fertilizer. But on the milk standpoint here, we got an extension on DMC sign-up, dairy margin coverage program. The forecast is that there could be payments first 8 months of the year. Then dairy revenue protection has become very popular, insuring roughly 30 to 35% of the milk. How important is it for dairy farmers to look at that moving forward in 2023?
Yeah, I think the dairy margin coverage program is kind of foundational for farms of kind of all different sizes. If you look historically at it, especially at that 950 margin that you can get on the tier one, the first 5 million pounds of annual production, that has historically paid about 2/3 of the months. And the forecast, like you said, Corey, you can go online and look at the tool, which I think does a nice job of forecasting what those payments could be. It looks like there could, you know, be some payments in the, you know, first few months of the year, and it's likely to pay for itself. Now that's not big enough for some operations to kind of take care of all their kind of price risk management issues. And that's where kind of dairy RP comes in. But price of dairy RP being based off of dairy options is going to depend a lot on how much kind of volatility the market thinks there is out there, how much kind of downside risk there is, right? Because the more downside risk, the higher you're going to have, it's going to cost you, but then that's subsidized as a crop insurance program. So both programs to definitely take a hard look at going into 2023.
Steve, the next question for you is another one of our listeners asked, what's your advice to optimize feed efficiency to help in feed cost reduction?
Well, I'll go back to something I said a minute ago, the make sure you're milking the right cows. So the feed efficiency killers on a dairy are late lactation cows that eat a lot of feed and don't give a lot of milk. And so the industry has some fewer of those now. We see fewer fat than we used to. I think the industry as a whole has figured out how to get cows pregnant in a timely fashion. So that's really good for feed conversion. So just remember that the cows that are going to make your feed conversion numbers what you want are those peaking cows, and also holding on to those peaks. So almost every good thing that you do for a cow with a well-balanced ration, keeping her comfortable, getting her pregnant on time, all those things are going to allow you to win on feed conversion, feed efficiency. But still, you know, things like even going back to the risk that we have out west, where we're living at, you know, 37 to 40% forage rations. You know, those rations tend to travel through the cow at a potentially higher rate. So we have a risk of higher feed intake, less digestibility realized, and therefore we may like our milk, but it may be taking 2-3 pounds more dry matter intake to get that done than if we had a ration that was 60% forage. So if you do find yourself stretching forage, stretching inventories, whether because you don't have it or you can't afford it, or you want to try to feed less forage, just make really sure you're going back to the basics on things like the Penn State shaker box and just good cow sense to make sure that we're not bending rules to try to react to present realities and then end up with with a poor result, particularly in the feed conversion area. It's efficiency is where it's at right now. We've got to make sure every dollar works for us. A dollar invested in feed works for us, and you know, feed conversion is the best way to measure that.
Joe, the final audience question we have in the queue here, let's turn it your way. What's the value of winter forages like rye or triticale or any others that you have in mind in terms of helping bridge this feed situation?
Yeah, that's a great question. To me, it comes kind of back to your infrastructure on the farm. So we know that these winter cereals can be a very high quality forage if they're harvested timely in the spring. But some of the bottlenecks that might limit that benefit, or do you have a place to store it on the farm that it's you can kind of feed it to the right group of animals at the right time, and how is it going to impact your other field operations? You know, we run into scenarios, especially in the Northeast and other areas where our springs tend to come late and be wet, that if trying to harvest that cover crop comes at the cost of later first cutting of your perennial forages or later corn planting or not getting all your manure out on time, you know, you could end up in a scenario where the opportunity cost is higher than what you would realize as a benefit from getting that extra forage. So that's the way I look at it, is it is an opportunity, but it has to fit your system.
Steve, anything to add on that?
Yeah, I think there again, it's going to be a lot determined by the region and your geography. We have some places we work with that where winter cool season annuals are a very significant part of our diets, and there tends to be two camps on cool season forages, and most times you get in a situation where you wish you had an extra week in the calendar either between it and something else or before it, but we can't do that. So my general approach out west has been to, when we use those type species of grass, is to go ahead and farm them for some yield. We tend to, if we get overly excited about harvesting 18-19% protein wheatlage or oatlage or stuff like that, the risk, the storage risks on that type of material in places I work is just really high. So you may get some very awesome testing stuff that's full of butyric acid that's really unfeedable. Where most of the places I work, we need more forage. We just let that stuff grow. And yeah, the NDFD won't be as good as you like, and the protein is going to be lower than you wish it was. But, you know, the tonnage numbers are going to be good, and that's going to make it cost less. And when it's all said and done, we can have inputs that we can buy that can take that forage and turn it into what we need it to be in the diet.
If I could just jump back, and I totally agree with all of that. You know, again, back to kind of the bottlenecks in the system, is we do have farms that'll leave that for a later cutting for yield, but that can further impact whether you can turn around and get a corn plant crop planted on time or not. And also, you know, we also have farms that will cut it high or cut it earlier and actually go with less yield, because we know if the windrows get too heavy in a humid climate, you get into those issues Steve's mentioning about butyric acid and stuff. So we actually have some farms, if they want the quality, will sacrifice a little bit of yield to make it more manageable in the field.
So I want to thank everyone for the robust discussion. One of our audience members really didn't ask a question, but gave a really great comment. And the comment is this: these days, dairy today is one big science experiment. And quite frankly, that's true as we move through the issues at hand. Our next Dairy Live stream, titled New Congress, New Legislation, will air on Wednesday, January 11th, 2023, 11 o'clock Central Time. And that episode, just like this one, will be archived on our Hordes Dairymen YouTube channels and our podcast channels the very next day. We look forward to seeing you then. On behalf of Gary Schnittke, Joe Lawrence, Steve Martin, and Chris Wolf, I am Corey Geiger, your host today. Thank you for joining us. We wish you all a great day and a most joyful, safe, and happy holiday season with your families. Take care, everyone.